Chapter 15. The Mother of Harlots and Abominations. Before the day on which the theology of Rome was inspired by Satan, the world had certainly witnessed many dark deeds, but vice had never been clothed with the mantle of theology. The most shameful forms of iniquity had never been the objects of the most minute study. Under the pretext of saving the world and glorifying God, let those who would understand read The Priest, The Woman, and The Confessional, and decide whether they are not enough to shock the feelings of the most depraved. Has the world ever witnessed such sacrilege? A young man about 20 years of age has been enticed to make a vow of perpetual celibacy, and the very next day the Church of Rome fills his memory with the most disgusting images. Rome does not even try to conceal the overwhelming power of this kind of teaching, but bravely tells them that the study of those questions will act with an irresistible power upon their organs, and without a blush says that pollutions must follow. But in order that she may more certainly destroy her victims, she tells them, "There is no sin for you in these pollutions." How can the Roman Catholic nations hope to raise themselves in the scale of Christian dignity and morality as long as there remain a priest in their midst, bound in conscience every day to pollute the minds and the hearts of their mothers, their wives, and their daughters? And let me say once for all that I do not speak from contempt or unchristian feeling against the professors who initiated me into these mysteries of iniquity. They were crushed, like us, under a yoke which bound their understanding and polluted their hearts without measure. Every time they gave us our lessons, it was evident that they blushed in the inmost part of their souls. Their conscience, as honest men, were forbidding them to open their mouths on such matters, while on the other hand, as slaves and priests of the Pope, they were compelled to speak without reserve. After our lessons, we students were filled with such shame that sometimes we hardly dared to look at each other. More than one of my fellow students told me with tears of shame and rage that they regretted to have bound themselves by perpetual oath to minister at the altars of the church. One day, one of the students, De Saulnier, who was sick in the same room with me, asked Chinnicky, "What do you think of our present theological studies? Is it not a burning shame that we must allow our minds to be so polluted?" "I cannot sufficiently tell you my feelings of disgust," I answered. "Do you know," said Desolunay, "that I am determined never to consent to be ordained as a priest? For when I think of the fact that the priest is bound to confer with the women on all these polluting matters, I feel an insurmountable disgust and shame." "I am not less troubled," I replied. "My heart aches and my heart sinks when I hear our theologians telling us that we will be in conscience bound to speak to strange women on matters so defiling. But we are near the hour at which the good Mr. Leprechaun is in the habit of visiting us. Will you," I said, "promise to stand by me in what I will ask him on this subject?" I am sure our pure and holy superior has never said a word to females on those degrading matters. In spite of all the theologians, surely he will allow us to keep our tongues and our hearts, as well as our bodies, pure in the confessional. I have had the desire to speak for him, to him for some time, rejoined de Saulnier, but my courage always failed me. I will certainly support you. If we are at liberty never to speak to women on these horrors, I will consent to serve the church as a priest, but if not, I will never be a priest. A few minutes later, our superior entered to see how we were. I thanked him and opened the volumes of Dins and Gory to one of the infamous chapters and said to him with a blush, "After God, you have the first place in my heart since my mother's death, and you know it. Therefore, I trust you will tell me all I want to know in these hours of anxiety. I have taken the vows of perpetual celibacy, but I had not a clear understanding of what I was doing. Dins, Ligori, and St. Thomas have directed our minds into regions which were quite new and unexplored by us. For God's sake, please tell us if we will be bound in conscience to speak in the confessional to the married and unmarried women on such impure and defiling questions." "Most undoubtedly," replied Reverend Mr. Lepfelhorn, "because the learned and holy theologians are positive on that question, it is absolutely necessary for, as a general thing, girls and married women are too timid to confess those sins. Therefore, they must be helped by questioning them." "But," I rejoined, "we have made an oath that we should always remain pure and undefiled. Would it not be better to experience those things in the holy bonds of marriage, according to the laws of God, than in company and conversation with strange women?" Here de Saulnier interrupted me. "My dear Mr. Lepfelhorn, I concur in everything Chiniki has just been telling you. I ask you, my dear sir, what will become of my vows of perfect and perpetual chastity when the seducing presence of my neighbor's wife or the enchanting words of his daughter will have defiled me through the confessional? After all, I may be looked upon by the people as a chaste man, but what will I be in the eyes of God? Men will think that I am an angel of purity, but my own conscience will tell me that I am nothing but a skillful hypocrite, for according to all the theologians and the confessional, in the tomb of the chastity, the confessional is the tomb of the chastity of priests." De Saulnier's fearless and energetic words had evidently made a very painful impression upon our superior. It was not a usual thing for his disciples to speak with such freedom. He did not conceal his pain at what he called our unbecoming and unchristian attack upon some of the most holy ordinances of the church. After he had refuted de Saulnier as best he could, he turned to me. "My dear Chiniki, I have repeatedly warned you against the habit you have of listening to your own frail reasoning. Were we to believe you, we would immediately set to work to reform the church and abolish the confession of women to priests. We would throw all our theological books into the fires and have new ones written, better adapted to your fancy. The devil of pride is tempting you as he has tempted all the so-called reformers. If you do not take care, you will become another Luther. The theological books of St. Thomas, Ligori, and Dins have been approved by the church. On one side, then, I see all our holy popes and Catholic bishops, all our learned theologians and priests, and on the other side, what do I see? Nothing but my small, though very dear Chiniki. Is it not just as observed for you to reform the church by your small reason as it is for a grain of sand at the foot of the great mountain to try to turn that mighty mountain out of its place. Take my friendly advice, continued our superior, before it is too late. Let the small grain of sand remain still at the foot of the majestic mountain. All the good priests before us have had their souls saved even when their bodies were polluted, for those carnal pollutions are nothing but human miseries which cannot defile a soul which desires to remain united to God. So the heart of a good priest, as I hope my dear Chenecky will be, will remain pure and holy in spite of the accidental and unavoidable defilement of the flesh. Apart from those things, in your ordination you will receive a special grace which will change you into another man, and the Virgin Mary, to whom you will constantly address yourself, will obtain for you a perfect purity from her Son. The defilement of the flesh spoken of by the theologians, and which I confess is unavoidable when hearing the confessions of women, must not trouble you, for they are not sinful, as Dins and Liguori assure us. But enough, I forbid you to speak to me any more on those idle questions, and as much as my authority is anything to you both, I forbid you to say a word more to each other on that matter. I had hoped for some good and reasonable arguments, but he, to my surprise, silenced the voice of our conscience by a coup d'etat. De Saulnier, just as he had foretold me, refused to be a priest. He remained all his life in the orders of sub-deaconate in the College of Nicolet as a professor of philosophy. He was a good logician and a profound mathematician, and although affable to everyone, he was not communicative. I was probably the only one to whom he opened his mind concerning the great questions of Christianity, faith, history, the church, and her discipline. He repeatedly said to me, I wish I had never opened a book of theology. Our theologians are without heart, soul, or logic. Many of them approve of theft, lies, and perjury. Others drag us without a blush into the most filthy pits of iniquity. Every one of them would like to make an assassin of every Catholic. According to their doctrine, Christ is nothing but a Corsican brigand, whose bloodthirsty disciples are bound to destroy all the heretics with fire and sword. Were we acting according to the principles of those theologians, we would slaughter all Protestants with the same coolness as we would shoot the wolf. With their hand still reddened with the blood of St. Bartholomew, they speak to us of charity, religion, and God. For me, the idea of that miserable grain of sand which so ridiculously attempted to remove the stately mountain singularly struck and humbled me. I remained silent and confused, though not convinced. Almost every month which I had passed in the seminary of Nicolet, priests of the district of Three Rivers and elsewhere were sent by the bishops to spend 2 or 3 weeks in doing penances for having bastards by their nieces, their housekeepers, or their fellow penitents. These public and undeniable facts were not much in harmony with those beautiful theories of our venerable director, but my respect for Mr. Lepfrohan sealed my lips. In my room I fell on my knees to ask God to pardon me for having for a moment thought otherwise than the popes and theologians of Rome. But alas, I was not yet aware that when Jesus in his mercy sends into a perishing soul a single ray of his grace, that there is more light and wisdom in that soul than in all the popes and theologians of Rome, which are so well calculated to keep the world fettered in ignorance and superstition.